Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we look at the root cause of child misbehavior. Now we're not talking routine behavioral problems, truly disruptive child, the kind that can create dysfunction in the classroom and chaos and conflict at home. My guest today is Dr. Nancy Rappaport, an assistant professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Her work is focused on the collaboration between education and psychiatry. Before becoming a psychiatrist, Rappaport was a classroom teacher at an innovative elementary school in Harlem. In fact, a documentary that focused on her work, The Children's Storefront, was nominated for an Oscar in 1988. Since becoming a psychiatrist, she's worked on mentoring roles in education and how teachers can intervene with chronic disruptive students in the classroom. And that's the focus of her latest book, which is really designed for teachers, but it's also designed for parents as well. It's called The Behavior Code, a practical guide to understanding and teaching the most challenging students. It's published by Harvard Education Press. She's co-author along with special educator Jessica Minahan. Dr. Nancy Rappaport joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Dr. Rappaport, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
I'm so happy to talk with you.
You know, it's estimated, I think the first line in your book says it's estimated that close to 10% of the American school-age population suffers from some sort of mental health problem along a wide spectrum. So in a class of 20 to 30, that means there's probably at least two or three children that are really causing a disruptive classroom setting. So how can those two or three kids impact the classroom?
Well, what happens is that children can try to communicate, and sometimes people are, just like all of us, are more sophisticated than others. So if a child is, every time you make a demand as a teacher or a parent, ends up, you know, throwing a desk or talking back, that can derail a teacher from being able to deliver curriculum to the rest of the classroom. So what we were hoping to provide in the behavior code was a way of saying to a teacher, if you're struggling, or a parent, if you're struggling with a child's behavior, here are some ways to sort of turn yourself into a detective and try to come up with concrete strategies. That's what we really wanted to do, so you could figure out an approach the next day. So we chose to focus on four different behaviors. The student with anxiety-related behavior, which is more about get away from me. The student with oppositional behavior, sort of you're not the boss of me. And the student with withdrawn behavior. And the student with sexualized behavior. And those were Jessica Minahan, who is my co-author, and myself have been collectively working with schools over 30 years. And these were the behaviors that we felt that if we could give a cheat sheet to parents and teachers about how you could structure your approach, that this would be really helpful.
And actually, you know, what was fascinating to me was that of those four types of sort of root causes, the misbehavior can be remarkably similar in nearly all three to four of those categories.
Thank you. I'm so glad, Richard, that you're highlighting that, because what you're highlighting is what we wanted to say, which is that sometimes people can jump to assumptions about a child's behavior, and they can think either that he's doing this because he wants to terrorize me, or he's manipulative. And our premise is that kids would do well if they could do well. And part of our job as parents, as caretakers, as school teachers, is to really begin to try to understand what's going on. And we talk about the FAIR approach, and the first thing is to figure out what's the function of the approach. And a lot of behavior analysts, and Jessica is a behavior analyst, I'm a child psychiatrist, but behavior analysts look at what's going on before, what's the antecedent, what's the behavior, and then what are the consequences. So let's just take a kid who is in a classroom and is sitting next to another child on the computer and then shoves him and says, it's my turn, and gets onto the computer. A teacher could see that and make an understandable assumption that what she needs to do is to teach this child about how important it is to share.
Uh-huh.
And that's certainly something that, you know, K through 6, we're always trying to teach kids that about that. But maybe what's really going on for this child is that he really lacks social skills, and what he was trying to do was to get this child's attention. And he had come up and said, you know, whatever. He kind of tried to get, you know, good morning or whatever, couldn't get it, and then he just got a little, this was his way of trying to get attention from the other student. So what he may need differently would be support around how do you make contact, how do you start a conversation with another student, more than a lesson about sharing.
You know, as I was reading through the book, too, it just struck me as how, I have to imagine how unprepared most classroom teachers are to deal with this behavior, because, you know, the natural reaction when you see this behavior is to say, what the heck is wrong with this kid? And maybe just saying, not going into the home environment or what else is going into their life, but just to personalize that. And I think that's a very difficult thing to separate.
I would say that me being a child psychiatrist, one of the most important aspects, both when I work with parents who have teenagers and with my own self being a therapist, is not to take things personally and to be able to distance yourself. And that's part of what our hope is to give some tools so that you feel more in charge. Because oftentimes what can happen, let's just say you have a student who, you know, usually make minimal requests. Can you do this math homework, or can you pass out pencils? And all of a sudden you have a child that's explosive. You can have, and I've had this because I've done assessments in schools for over 20 years, you can have a teacher become very beleaguered and say, you know what, I just feel like I'm walking on pins and needles, and I don't know when I can expect my student to blow. Oftentimes we say, you know, at the initial point I was saying, you want to look at the antecedents and the behaviors and the consequences and look for patterns. But with children who are anxious, often their patterns are unpredictable. And we liken it to the idea of if you took a soda can and shook it up, if I put it behind my back, you wouldn't know once I showed you the two cans of sodas which of those soda cans would you open up and end up having it spill all over the place. And similarly, a lot of times when kids are anxious, they don't come in with a capital A on their forehead. And yet there are ways that we could say, both to parents and teachers, look for certain things that are going to make your kids anxious, and let's teach you how to manage that. So you're exactly right. The teachers, and we know teachers are our heroes and heroines, they are the future. They are investing in the future of our children. And we kind of have this hope that this would become like, it's been doing well, but we hope it becomes a classroom Bible where, you know, especially new teachers, but also veteran teachers can say, you know what, I get stuck sometimes, and here's a chance for me just to step back and come back with a fresh perspective.
And I would think that the temptation for teachers when you are confronted with this sort of behavior is either to get them out of my classroom, or if I can't get them out of my classroom, you know, to ignore that child for the most part and basically write them off.
Right. And it's not because teachers are trying to be negligent. It's
but they have 25 other kids, yes, in the class that they have to educate. And now in this day and age, you know, there's testing involved high stakes.
Exactly. So I would say it's kind of like when you have parents who say, I hit my child because that gets them to do what they do, mm-hmm, what I need them to do. And I would say, well, you know, the problem is, first of all, there are laws against hitting your child, but also it stops working.
Yeah.
And so maybe you get that one kid out of the class that was oppositional, that was derailing your class, and you breathe a sigh of relief, or June comes and you say, thank God. But there's going to be another child who's oppositional. So at what point do you say, you know what, I need to have some more tools in my toolbox, because if I can catch it early, and, you know, the problem is that we wrote this predominantly for kindergarten to sixth grade teachers or parents, because those are the teachers that are spending the most time with kids. And what our premise is, if you can front load and spend time proactively trying to support your students, that it'll pay off. And that the time you're spending reprimanding a child or redirecting them is about the time that it's going to take for you to come up with them. So let's just take an oppositional kid. One of the things we talk about is controlled choices. We all know when you have a toddler, you tell them you can have the red chair or you can have the blue chair, and that gets you out of a lot of standoffs. Another thing that we would talk about is when you make a demand of a child, make it, step away, give them some time to process it, because sometimes a kid needs to save face, and giving a delayed demand, so for instance saying, you know what, I need you to clean up what's on the floor before lunch, and giving a 15-minute window gives a child a time to recollect themselves and save face, and you're not engaged in a battle. So sometimes people will say to me, you know what, the problem is, and I really don't like this, we get into the blame game. Well, if parents would just teach their kids how to do X, Y, and Z, then teachers wouldn't do that. You know, I'm a very practical person, even though, you know, I'm assistant prof at Harvard. I'm looking for practical, strategic responses, and I don't think the blame game helps. What I want is I want these kids to learn the tools they need so they can stay in school and teachers can teach.
And one of the things we have to remember, and you write at the very beginning of the book, that all behaviors are communication. Even though it seems to be not communicating any message at all at first glance, this is a form of communication, and there's a reason why the child is doing it. And it's usually not a manipulation or just being bratty or whatever. A lot of times there is a serious cause beneath this misbehavior.
Well, Rich, I so appreciate how carefully you've read this. And what I want to build on with what you're saying is the idea, Mark Durand is a psychologist who talks about there are four reasons for behavior. And it can sound overly simplistic when I walk you through them, but to me, if you just try this when you're looking at your child or your student, it's really helpful. So the four causes that he would talk about is attention, escape, tangible, and sensory. So attention we all know, but sometimes we forget is that some kids like negative attention better than no attention. So we have to figure out how to structure it so that we can give positive interaction and cut them at the pass. Escape is fairly straightforward. Tangible is saying you want what you want when you want it, and you want concrete things, an iPod, a check if we go to work, the computer, various things. And sensory is it feels good, tastes good, and looks good. So you're right that a lot of times, say if you take biting, which fortunately doesn't happen too often, kindergarten through sixth grade, but with little kids, you know, under six, maybe they'll bite. And I was just talking with a friend of mine and saying, you know, maybe it's that this little boy who's like 2.5 years old has trouble communicating because he hasn't quite figured out words. So what he's doing is biting to let you know either that he's angry or he wants attention because he gets a huge amount of attention when he bites, or he wants something and he can't figure out how to get it except for if he bites his sister. And so once you figure out what it is they're trying to communicate, then you figure out a replacement behavior. So the kid who explodes every time you give a math test, if you tell them, you know, maybe it's going to take a while for them to get better at the math, but math is hard for them, and what they may need to do is take a break first or learn to ask for help. And that's what you're going to replace with as you're trying to build their skill. You eliminate them having an explosion, hopefully, to escape doing the math.
I'm glad you mentioned the sensory part of it, because there was a whole, you know, whole section on these sort of classroom behaviors which are very annoying, you know, everything from humming or, you know, nervous tics or something like that, and the child is getting good stimulus from that, and it's a very difficult thing for them to stop.
Yes, and so you might see that particularly with autistic kids.
Yeah, on the spectrum, yeah.
Yes, where they may end up chewing things. And again, that would be a perfect example of giving a replacement, so that instead of chewing, you know, their nails or their arm or their wrist, that you can give them chewy toys or try to provide a substitute initially so that they're not harming themselves.
But even like sometimes attention deficit issues, that can show up like humming or fidgeting.
Yeah.
Of some sort. And again, there's a sensory part of that.
Mm-hmm. And trying to figure out, can we provide an alternative? So so that if you're fidgeting, if you're rocking back and forth in your chair, that could drive a teacher nuts. But if you could give them a keychain that they could tie to their belt and it had maybe some rosary beads on them that they were able to fidget with, you know, that might avoid the constant redirection and allow them to sort of be able to sit still. Or you put balls underneath the chairs, tennis balls I've seen in classrooms.
Yeah, that's true. My guest today is Dr. Nancy Rappaport, an assistant professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. She is co-author, along with special educator Jessica Minahan, of The Behavior Code, A Practical Guide to Understanding and Teaching the Most Challenging Students. It's published by Harvard University Press. And before we actually talk about the FAIR system, which is, it's a very interesting system you have for really getting to the root of the behaviors, I want to go back to, you know, how anxiety, oppositional, withdrawn, sexualized behavior can sound absolutely polar opposite as far as what the tangible effects will be. And we kind of touched on this earlier, but the fact that a child suffering from anxiety is not going to show frightened sort of symptoms, they're going to show aggressive symptoms. And that those other areas can also show symptoms that really don't match the base feelings that's going on within the child.
You're right. I mean, there are definitely, we all know, some people who are anxious and they break out into a cold sweat, get nervous, avoid what they need to do, and you know it's anxiety. But there are many students who may have had trauma happen at home, but may not have had trauma happen at home. And the way, you know, they may have a learning difficulty and they get anxious every time they approach a certain subject. And what they don't tell us is they're anxious. What they communicate is a level of frustration and maybe potentially aggression, which is driven by the anxiety. So an example would be sometimes you'll see kids who have anxiety who have terrific difficulty around transitions or have trouble with recess and lunch because there's so many kids in the, children with Asperger's, autism, who may have social interaction difficulties may find recess and lunch enormously difficult. And again, if you do the looking for the function, you may see if you jot down some notes, you might notice that the antecedent to a child being having meltdowns at the end of the afternoon, it seems to start unravel around lunch. So then you can get creative about, could we potentially provide an alternative lunch where the child has an opportunity either to eat with the guidance counselor or to have a social skills group during lunchtime or a smaller group so that they're not having these explosions at the end of the day. Another aspect is around transitions. So kids who may have trouble waiting, sometimes my co-author's been in the classroom and it's 7 minutes from the announcement of we're transitioning to music, and during that 7 minutes a child can get in a lot of trouble. And providing waiting toys or waiting activities that they can do, which parents know instinctively when they go to a restaurant because that's an obvious place where you have to wait for food, they'll bring things like crayons for them to draw and different stuff like that. But sometimes in the school setting, kids will constantly be getting into trouble, and we haven't been able to target that these are actually children who have troubles with transitions, and we need to have some concrete ways of helping them get through that.
Well, in our remaining time, let's talk a little bit about the FAIR system, which you've come up with. First, the acronyms. What does FAIR stand for?
Sure. So FAIR, first of all, was sort of meant to be the idea that, building on the idea that sometimes teachers will think it's not fair, kids won't think it's fair, that kids need these special accommodations. But our sense is, it's good for all kids to succeed. So that's the way to remember it. But F is for the function of the behavior. So again, it's looking at antecedents, behaviors, and consequences, and trying to figure out, is this attention, is this escape tangible or sensory? A is for accommodations, so it's the kinds of modifications that you might make either in the schedule or in providing breaks for kids or helping to figure out what are the skills that you need to build for a child. And then the I is for the interaction. So some of the things that I was talking about with how you might approach an oppositional child, I is for interaction. And R is for the response. Once you have a meltdown, what do you do to try to kind of regroup and move forward? So that's the acronym FAIR. And we hope that we have very specific steps for each kind of child, and that this could become something that could be a basis for if the school is having a team meeting, that they could look at some of these suggestions and see which ones might be helpful for an individual child, and that they could be included in an individual education plan.
Yeah. The functionality part of it is it involves basically a pretty detailed record keeping on every incident of misbehavior. How does that record keeping help you get to the essence of the misbehavior, if you will?
Because sometimes when you're in the firing line, you don't have a chance to be reflective. And both Jess and I have read hundreds of incident reports of times when kids have been explosive. And often what happens is there's minute description of the episode, but not what was going on before and what was going on afterwards. So, for example, if a kid acts up in class and they end up, the consequence of that is that they're taken out into the hall and they're given a 5-minute lecture by a teacher. If partly what drives their behavior is to get attention, what happens is the teacher
is feeding
inadvertently
it.
Has reinforced that. Oh. So we're trying to say, of course we know how much teachers are being asked to do, although we found teachers with coaxing, bubble bath or bottle of wine, are willing to do this. And that being able to look for, is this attention, is this escape, starts to pop out if you look at the patterns. And we're not saying do this with 30 kids in the classroom. We're saying you're up against the wall with one or two children. Take the time, usually hopefully with just one child, and see if you can determine the pattern by looking at the antecedent and looking what's happening. And then we try to show the patterns in the book to say, this is what, you know, here's some training to do that and make it. And also the other thing is teachers aren't alone. Many times they have social workers or inclusion specialists that are in the school building. So this is something where they would want to work with other school members that are on the team. Mm-hmm. And we also wanted to give people tools, parents especially. A lot of times behavior plans in schools backfire, particularly with kids with anxiety, because they're based on Johnny's going to raise his hand, Johnny's going to be a perfect kid, and if he is, he gets 2 points, and then he gets, you know, whatever, stickers. And what it doesn't emphasize is what are the skills that Johnny needs to show us to do this behavior that we want. So we would much rather have a behavior plan focused on the skills that he needs to learn versus the behavior he needs to show.
So would you say patience rather than raising your hand before speaking?
It would be, say, the skill of counting to four.
Okay, gotcha. Right.
Because patience is too abstract.
Yeah,
okay. You won't know what that means.
Right, exactly. So,
yeah.
Okay, all right.
Yeah. But you're learning fast, Rich. Give me another.
Well, so you create this chart. We mentioned this before, but the what was happening before the incident and what consequence happened after the incident, this can tell you a lot about what's going on with a kid and also how the system is sort of interacting with this child and either rewarding or punishing the child for this misbehavior.
I mean, an understandable one is many times kids get sent off to the principal's office. But if the intent of the behavior is
anxiety,
to escape the task,
yeah, and anxiety about that task.
Yeah. Then what you've done is you've actually reinforced it, and they figure out, you know what, if I act up in class, I get to escape off to the principal's office. And even though as a teacher you may think getting a phone call home to the parents would be a deterrent, there actually might be a much bigger deterrent to avoid the task.
Mm-hmm. And this is where the second part comes in, accommodations. Maybe you were removed from the classroom, but here's the thing you wanted to avoid. It goes with you?
It could be that, or it could be that you say, you know what, this child has a lot of anxiety about starting a task. That's what I notice, is that he doesn't think he can write. He's terrified of writing, and he has problems with writing. So what we need to do is to help him with generating ideas, or
so a prompt,
or give him some prompts, or make the task, say it's math, make it that he starts the first two problems and then you give him the next two afterwards. Or maybe you preview at the beginning of the day what's going to happen for him, like with a second grader who's terrified that he's not going to do well in the math, and get him over that hump so he's not acting up before then to avoid it.
My guest today is Dr. Nancy Rappaport, assistant professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, co-author with special educator Jessica Minahan of The Behavior Code, a practical guide to understanding and teaching the most challenging students. It's published by the Harvard University Press. Well, so once you begin documenting all these misbehaviors and start putting in accountability, what happens next?
Well, then the other thing is what we were talking about is the interaction strategies.
Right. Uh-huh.
So sometimes, let's say with a withdrawn child, they may think that they're not likable. And so one of the things we would talk about in an interaction strategy would be, sounds fancy, but it's really not that fancy, is non-contingent reinforcements. And what that means is random acts of kindness. Oftentimes, kids can feel like, you know what, the reason that my teacher likes me or my dad likes me is because I'm a great student, or I need to be perfect. And sometimes with kids, particularly if they have feelings bad about themselves, what they need to be reminded is that you like them just because of who they are. So you may end up, you know, as a teacher, giving them a sticker just because you were thinking about them and you know that they love bunnies, so you give them a bunny sticker. Or maybe their favorite sport is soccer, so you print out a soccer page. And these are just small acts of kindness that can end up building a connection between the teacher and the student. And sometimes I find, especially those oppositional kids, they're the hardest kids sometimes to like. And what they really need is to, the kid that's pushing you away the hardest is sometimes the kid that you need to build the relationship with the most. And so that's another, you know, that would be something that you would talk about in your FAIR plan, would be that. Or it's that you realize that you're in a struggle with, you know, oppositional, so you want to think about in your interaction strategies, where can I put in choice within my curriculum, within my requests, and how can I do that? So that would be around interaction.
Okay. Well, just a last minute or so, I know you've been doing clinical studies on this system over years, and can you give us a sense of what sort of difference this makes in the classroom when you have teachers that are willing to go through this process? And, I mean, does it change the behavior around?
This can make a huge difference, and Jessica is a behavior analyst, and she generates graphs that can show how these interventions can decrease the behavior and have a child be able to function in school. And that was our investment, to get this kind of information out to teachers and to parents. And we were lucky enough that Harvard Education Press was willing to join with us and make it available to people, so that people could, you know, pick up the behavior code and get some guidance about how can we intervene with some kids who are really struggling in school and make a difference in their behavior.
All right. Well, Dr. Rappaport, well, we appreciate your time today. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Nancy Rappaport is the co-author of The Behavior Code, a practical guide to understanding and teaching the most challenging students, published by Harvard University Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.